another off-season episode of the 3-Bid League podcast. Hope everyone is staying safe and finding ways to enjoy themselves as best they can. Well, if you're looking for some enjoyment, I really believe that we got some good stuff here coming to you in these next 45 or so minutes. We're joined by Jay Burnham, the voice of UMass basketball, the radio play-by-play man for the Minutemen. Great conversation with Jay about the future of the Minutemen, led, of course, by Trey Mitchell and TJ Weeks. And then for those of you who maybe aren't super passionate UMass fans, you're looking for something else to talk about, we talk about the future of the A-10 as a whole. How does the league grow? How do they continue to compete in the changing landscape? This is a very fun interview. We go everywhere from the nitty-gritty of some of these great young UMass players to the full macro scale of the A-10 and where they exist in 2020's college basketball landscape. Enjoy. All right, we are joined here by the voice of UMass basketball, Jay Burnham. Jay, I hope you're ready to talk basketball here in this this gloomy April.
Guys, I'm itching to talk basketball, and I'm doing so from my car that's parked in my driveway, and I haven't shaved in about 12 days, so you're welcome.
Yeah, well, we got great news for you. We're not going to start by talking about the actual game of basketball. We're going to talk about the fashion of basketball. UMass's star Trey Mitchell trying to make the case for UMass to wear black jerseys next year. And as someone who's covered UMass basketball for a while, how do you feel about this fashion choice?
I love how you guys are so plugged into the UMass Twitter sphere, which is like its own slice of the internet, and sometimes dark, sometimes humorous. So I guess the athletic director, Ryan Bamford, had been chided by Trey on social media about wearing black jerseys. And then Trey straight up asked him, well, hey, how many retweets do we need to get these things going? And the AD said 25,000, which is a high number. I think as we record this, Trey's almost at about 2,000 retweets on that. I think it's sharp. You know, I think there's this weird, and you guys, when I listen to you guys do this podcast, there's so much A-10 history that I don't know, kind of coming in over the past couple of years, really paying attention to it a few years ago. People are really into uniforms.
Yeah.
Like, as a broadcaster, like, I don't really think much about them. I just kind of watch the game and call it. But, you know, fans really into the script and the history of them. And the players obviously, you know, really enjoy different styles of uniforms. So, I think it'd be fun. But, you know, we'll see how much clout these guys have in the social media world.
Yeah. Well, we have to give credit where it's due, though. I mean, since we started this podcast 2 years ago now, UMass hasn't been quite the most successful team on the court, but the social media presence is pretty incredible. And I mean, I think we would both say that UMass Twitter is definitely one of the best fan bases in the A-10.
It's so engaging. And, you know, I think I've heard you guys kind of, you know, talk about the struggles of the Minutemen program. And I mean, they're clear as day over the past several seasons. I think it gives you an idea as to, you know, the strength of what this program can be and they hope will be in the very near future, because there's so many, it's, well, obviously a large institution. It's a state institution with significant basketball history. I mean, I grew up in Western Massachusetts, you know, refuse to lose in the mid 90s was the slogan in these parts. And, you know, they've obviously been on rough times, but I think it gives you an idea if you want to kind of use the hockey program as a similar template where, you know, they all of a sudden became good 2 years ago and you're selling out the Mullen Center in front of 8,500 screaming fans. You know, basketball, once they get to that point in terms of competitive nature, will not only have the online screaming fans behind them, but also, you know, a filled up arena as well.
Yeah, the Minutemen are on the rise. And that actually leads me to really a question that I'm curious to ask someone who's so plugged into UMass Twitter. We're only a year removed from a lot of calls for Matt McCall to get fired. But now on our end, it seems like the UMass fans are pretty happy with him. Is that the sentiment you're getting too?
Yeah, you know, and look, I lived in Richmond for 6 years and I didn't hear one peep from the fire Chris Mooney mafia this year online. So, you know, what a difference a year makes. I think, and, you know, I've been locked up here, so hopefully my my isolation hasn't allowed me to lose touch from reality. I think people believe that McCall's a good coach and he's got the fiery spirit that you want to have in a guy at this level. I think what he needed was a little bit help on the recruiting side. And we've seen with the addition of Tony Bergeron and obviously the pipeline that they've created to Woodstock Academy, which is one of the best prep basketball programs in the country that Tony essentially built overnight, along with other programs that he essentially built from scratch. And I think you needed kind of that tandem to help the program go in the right direction. And that's what they've got going right now. And you saw from the incoming recruiting class, more of these guys coming in from Woodstock Academy. I had never heard of Woodstock Academy before, you know, 2 years ago. But I think that combination is starting to gel with those guys. And then the surrounding staff, Tyson Wheeler and Lucius Jordan, have been kind of good pieces in developing guys. But I mean, you guys know, we talk about rankings, and I had started throwing out that Twitter thread about the highest rated recruits for, you know, some of the different programs in the A-10. If you cannot develop guys, then it's all for naught. And if you can't get guys to buy into your system, it's all for naught. And so I think you're starting to see those pieces come together. And that's why you're seeing a lot of people online from the UMass side extremely excited about what next year is going to bring, because you have arguably the best returning player in the Atlantic 10 in Trey Mitchell. You've got a guy who was shooting 45% from 3-point range before he got injured after the 9th game of the season, and TJ Weeks coming back. And then you've got sort of some of these unknowns of guys that might provide a little toughness, a little grit along. I think that's why you're starting to see a lot of excitement surrounding this program, which frankly has been in the doldrums. And when you just look at the A-10 on paper, there's no reason why a large state school with a history of basketball success should be in the bottom third of the Atlantic 10.
Yeah, it definitely seems like there's a lot of optimism with the UMass program. And last year, I think the Minutemen really took a step in the right direction, going 8-10, getting what would have been the 8 seed in the A-10 tournament. And really, that was probably the best season in UMass in about 5 or 6 years. So yeah. I think with that kind of uprise and then bringing in another solid recruiting class, I understand the optimism. So I guess I was wondering, do you know anything about any of these new guys coming in? Anyone that you think can really make a contribution heading into next season?
Yeah. You know, that's obviously a tough question, right? Mm-hmm. I would say this kind of look, and not to bore your audience with just being specific to UMass, I'll try to kind of broaden it a little bit. When you look at the season a year ago, the way that it went for the Minutemen, I mean, they beat VCU, which obviously didn't have the year that everybody expected them to have. They beat St. Louis. They took St. Louis in the first game of conference play into overtime and had a 5-point lead that they squandered. They lost to Dayton at home by 7, but they went 9 minutes in the first half without a basket. Obviously, you can't do that against one of the top teams in the country. Mm-hmm. So I think you're back to the level of, hey, the A-10 disparity has shrunk from the teams that are at the top to the middle, which is where UMass feels they are, and you're in it every single night. One of the things that I think has circled this program over the past couple of the seasons is the roster changes. And we saw a little bit more of that this offseason, not to the extent that Rhode Island had, but you know, you got guys transferring and guys, maybe, I don't know, I'm just sort of speculating, maybe seeing some of the writing on the wall that the guys they're bringing in could outplay them for starting time. You know, you lost your starting point guard, Sean East, who as a freshman played 35 minutes a game for the Minutemen. You know, he transferred to Bradley. The two point guards they're bringing in are Javon Garcia, who's a Brewster Academy kid, a Brewster team that is loaded with high major Division I players, and he was coming off the bench. And they feel he's going to make an immediate impact as a guy that can get downhill, can get to the rim a little bit more than Sean East did last season, can operate the offense a little bit better. And then sort of the wild card here is what the transfer rule is going to be. Noah Fernandes is also a Woodstock Academy kid, but he played a season at Wichita State this past year, lost some playing time, I think, due to injury, but as a guy that UMass really wanted to have 2 years ago, now they're having him come back to his home state where they hope that they can get him a transfer waiver, regardless of what that transfer rule is going to be. And then you have sort of two point guards that can help move the offense outside of just being one guy in Trey Mitchell. So, you know, I don't know if that answers your question, but that is sort of how I have perceived what they've set up here in terms of trying to add some pieces around, you know, the guy in the middle.
Yeah, and one of the most important pieces is going to be TJ Weeks, who is expected to recover from that injury that he suffered in December. And I know personally for myself, I'm a huge TJ Weeks fan in that first month and a half. And I see him as a future potential player of the year in this conference. What are you expecting to see from him this year?
So that was the big kind of blow for the Minutemen. And, you know, they planned coming in, and obviously what's the Mike Tyson line where, you know, everyone's game plan is the good one till you get punched in the mouth. Mm-hmm. You know, you had Carl Pierre and TJ Weeks, two pure shooters. And if one guy didn't have it one night, then you had the other guy that might be able to step up. And when you lost TJ, it really fell on Carl, who at times struggled significantly from long range. This is interesting when you tie it to recruiting. We're talking with TJ. He had, I think, two offers really at the mid-major level or below, low major. I think Fairfield and Hartford. And then you see him take the court, you see him shoot the basketball, and you're like, that's the most beautiful left-handed three-point shot. I mean, like, mm-hmm. if Ted Williams' swing for baseball was a three-point shot, that's what TJ Weeks' shot would be. I mean, it's just so pure and quite frankly artistic as it comes out of his hands. And I wonder, like, why these things aren't seen by other teams in the scouting realm or what have you. Obviously, he's a legacy player at UMass. His dad played here in the mid to late 90s. But I think he's a difference maker. I think one of the question marks would be, okay, he shot 45% from three-point range. He was actually the leading scorer for the Minutemen before he got injured. He did that against the non-conference schedule. That was a little bit lighter. Can he do it in the conference slate? And, you know, time will only tell in that regard.
I mean, he has maybe the most pure scoring ability and talent that I've seen from an A-10 freshman in years. And I'm including his teammate, Trey Mitchell, in that group. Those first nine games, he had so many moments where he, quite frankly, looked like a senior with the ball in his hands. He was comfortable from game one. It was really impressive.
Yeah. You know, let me throw it back on you guys, you know, and you're in the last 3 years. I mean, who's been the best pure 3-point shooter that you've seen in the Atlantic 10?
Yeah, I mean, he's definitely been one of them, and we haven't really seen it over a full season yet. But, you know, I think he's right up there, you know, with the best shooters in this conference, like the Ibby Watsons, Bones Highland, guys like that. I mean, if we see him do that over a whole season, I think that would just be such a huge boost to UMass's offense, because really, I think once we got to the second half of the season, Trey Mitchell, I think that's really when he started to pick up his game and he became one of the best players in the conference. But sometimes I felt like he didn't always get that help that he needed. And so when you add an elite 3-point shooter like that for next season, I think that's just going to be a huge difference maker.
Yeah. You know, when you're getting triple teamed in the post, mm-hmm. you should be able to kick it out and find a guy that's going to hit a shot, you know, 35 to 40% of the time. And I think that's what UMass was missing at times last year. I was trying to kind of allude to, you know, who are some of the other guys in the conference that you would equate his shooting ability with? I think Jeff Doughton was one of the best, like, mm-hmm. mid-range jumper guys that you've seen, you know, maybe not so much from the extended three-point line, but, you know, you know, Bones obviously had some games where he put up terrific threes, especially from deep. And I think TJ's got that ability as well.
Yeah. He's really unique in the fact that we haven't had a guy of that size and athleticism in this conference that can shoot the three ball that well in a very long time. I think of really the great three pointers of this conference. It's basically a lot of guards that come to mind. You think of somebody like Micah Mason from Duquesne a few years ago. He's a smaller guy, not anywhere near as athletic as Weeks. From a more recent end, a guy like Gibson Jimerson from St. Louis. Yeah. Once again, smaller guy. He's more of a role player sniper. We haven't had this kind of like basically tweener forward, a guy who can split his time between the three and the four and really attack the rim, who also has the shooting ability to come to go with it.
Yeah. You know who comes to mind now that I'm thinking of it? And you ever have those games where you see a guy just absolutely shred your team and he in your head becomes the best player that you've ever seen play? I had that effect with Davidson this year. I mean, they absolutely blew the doors off the Minutemen down in North Carolina. And now his name's escaping me, the freshman, Lee. I mean, that kid, not only fluid shot, but also a little bit of size, can get you multiple ways. I mean, he's a guy that's going to, you're going to have to contend with in the A-10 for the next three seasons. But yeah, like a guy that has that ability to maybe drive a little bit as well as kind of step back and shoot the three.
Yeah. I mean, Davidson's the place to look for the shooters, but once again, a guy like Kellen Grady has the athleticism that Weeks has, if not better, but he doesn't have the size. Jack Gibbs didn't have the size. Hyunjun Lee and Peyton Aldridge aren't quite as athletic. That's what makes Weeks so unique for a conference like this. Like, this is a player that you expect to see in the ACC or the Big East as opposed to the A-10.
Yeah, I mean, we'll see. Obviously, like, well, a whole season, hopefully he can kind of get back to where he was and be a pivotal part of this team going forward. Yeah, I mean, it's just a lot of fun to watch. I think he hit six threes in a game or against Ryder earlier this year, and that was just bombs away. You know, you mentioned Kellen Grady. This is part of the rebuilding of UMass basketball. Northfield Mount Hermon is right down the road from Amherst, Massachusetts, and that's where Kellen Grady went to prep school. You know, he's the number one all-time rated recruit at Davidson per 247. And their number two guy ever rated recruit is coming in this incoming class for McKillop. They just continue to reload. But trying to find a way, I think, for this program to keep some of those guys regionally. Hassan French is another one that comes to mind that actually played for Tony Bergeron at Commonwealth Academy in Springfield, another prep program that Bergeron built from the ground up. You know, so trying to see these guys that are in the area that have connections to the program, getting the program to the level where it's something that is desired and you want to be a part of and you want to help it grow. And I think that's certainly the direction they've got going. You know, I will say this, I see a lot of criticism on social media about, okay, well, you got one coach and one prep program and that's all you have. And Tony Bergeron, as I mentioned, started Commonwealth Academy, which is where Hassan French went. He's at Wings Academy in New York a while back. He's a five-star basketball guy with connections that are deeply rooted. And I think 75 guys that he had coached were playing Division I basketball, mid-major, low-major, high-major at some point over the last three seasons. So when people say, hey, what happens when your pipeline to that one school run out, I think they forget that this game and this world that we live in is all about relationships and how you treated people along the way. And those relationships are something that you have to have in the recruiting game. And Tony has them in spades.
Yeah. Bringing in a guy like Bergeron is a very high major move. You expect to see something like that from a big time program that recognizes, like you said, the value of those relationships. And it makes sense that he's bringing in his own guys in year one, because these are players that he knows more about than any other coach in the country. He knows plenty about a lot of these guys on this UMass roster. And guys who are good recruiters everywhere. I completely agree with you on that. And I really think we'll start to see in the next year or two, UMass will continue to get top talent, but they'll get it from new places.
Yeah, I think, well, what's the easiest way when you've got a crisis on hand, right? Okay, well, what's the easiest thing to do? Let's bring in the guys in your immediate circle, all right? Okay, that solidifies things. Now you stretch that circle even further the next year and then further the next year. So then you're trying to build that foundation, but to build it quickly, you start from your immediate, you know, close-knit group of people and families that you know, and I think that's what the Minutemen did and are still doing. You know, some of the other recruits they have coming in, Ronnie DeGray is one. He's a kind of a four, maybe three/four guy. His dad played at Colorado with Chauncey Billups. He's been a part of this Chauncey Billups camp or AAU program or what have you, part of the development of young basketball players. And DeGray is a two-year prep school kid. So he's actually, I think, older than some of the guys that you're going to have on your roster. And Coach Matt McCall was telling me the other day about bringing in these kids where, you know, you saw it last year where you started TJ Weeks, you started Trey Mitchell, you started Sean East for a significant amount of time. Like when you're bringing in these freshmen that have had multiple years of prep school under their belt and have been coached well and brought along well and have pedigree, then they're going to make an immediate impact. And especially now where you don't know what the future of this, of what anything's going to be really, but if they change the transfer rule, you know, you might have to lean on more guys at a younger age if you're losing players to the higher majors. I mean, that's a whole nother conversation, but, you know, so being comfortable with bringing guys in that can make an immediate contribution.
And we've been talking so much about the young on this roster, the great recruiting class, but I feel like we've kind of just glossed over Trey Mitchell, who was, I mean, there's really no way to say it. He was absolutely incredible last year. One of the big reasons is he took a noticeable big gap in production. As someone who's just closer and more plugged into UMass basketball than we are, what's something you saw with Mitchell that really kind of marked a change in his game? Maybe something that he developed, a change in his workout habits, just anything like that?
Well, you go back to picture day, right? For as freshmen and coming in, incoming summer class, where you take the headshots and you look at who he was 4 months after that, 5 months after that, his body type significantly changed, something he had been working on. You know, he was actually admittingly, he was a chubbier kid in high school, heavy set. He's turned himself into a lean, more athletic body. And then you saw actually the three-point shot have more success. I don't think it actually developed because I think it was good from the get-go, but he had a little bad luck in the early portion of the season. And then you go back to the last game of the year and he had, I think, 5 three-pointers or 6 three-pointers against Rhode Island. So being able to step out and shoot, that obviously enhanced his game. The thing that I hope will get him to the next level and that people will pay attention to is his footwork and continuously adding different moves in the post, like an old timey big man, you know, and being able to kind of go up against the best in the league, really. I mean, you know, you guys saw him against Obi, maybe not the first game, but we'll go to the second game.
Yeah.
Marcus Santos Silva, Hassan French. I mean, like experienced bigs in this league. And from an offensive and defensive standpoint, I mean, he really not only held his own, but excelled against some of those guys.
Yeah, I mean, I think the A-10 really, if you look at most of the good teams, one of the things they all have in common is that they have a good big man. And I really think Trey Mitchell, by the end of the year, he not only showed that he could hang with them, but that he was just as good as them, or in some cases, he was one of the best players on the court. And yeah. You know, he's one of the best recruits to come through the A-10 probably in the last few years, and he definitely lived up to the hype last season. I think the sky's the limit for that guy.
Yeah, and you know, like that's what we're talking about here recruiting-wise, guys that come in with the hype and then guys that can actually not only fulfill it but have the work ethic and tenacity and determination to get better. And I don't know if – look, everyone's different. I don't know – if the majority of guys that have been hyped throughout their life have that determination. And I've sat down with Trey a couple of the times and we told his story in a good piece we did that you can find on UMass Twitter about kind of where he came from and where he is now. He's got it, man. And like, he's incredibly intelligent as well. I mean, he chose UMass over the likes of Notre Dame and some of the other schools that were after him because of the business program that the University of Massachusetts has. Mm-hmm. He wants to work in finance. And I think we're going to be real lucky to watch him play. And I went on this, tried to go on this rant the other day on Twitter. And since I've got you guys, we can kind of dive into it here where you're talking about a conference I think we all kind of got shafted by not seeing Dayton make a run in the tournament this year. Obviously that would have been a lot of fun to watch, and it would have reflected very well on the Atlantic 10. Trying to create these programs that have interesting characters, great players, mm-hmm. phenomenal fan support, awesome media deals, and just intrigue that can elevate the league to be a consistent, to use the word for your podcast, three bid or four bid league.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know how or what, however that happens, but I feel like when you look at some of the markets, St. Louis, Dayton, Massachusetts, VCU, you know, even to a certain extent, George Washington and the nation's capital, like they are big markets that have good exposure and have the potential to be players, not only at the mid-major level. And so, you know, it helps when you have multiple of those good at the same time. And hopefully that's where we're going.
Yeah. I really think for the A10, you know, we need to kind of market ourselves as a basketball first conference. I mean, you look all across the conference, Dayton, basketball is everything here, St. Louis, VCU, Richmond. I mean, for a large majority of A10 schools, basketball is the focus. That's the number one sport on campus. And yeah, I really think, you know, as kind of there's a bigger divide between the football conferences and everyone else, all the other mid-majors. I think the A10 just needs to try to, you know, do what they can to stay in that zone where they can. I mean, the A10's never going to get, you know, 7 or 8 bids like the Big Ten, but it definitely has the tools to be the best mid-major conference out there.
Yeah. And, you know, I was thinking about this a lot because of the quarantine. Mm-hmm. I've been able to watch a lot of the ESPN 30 for 30s that I've been wanting to catch up on.
Yeah.
And to kind of equate it to the Requiem for the Big East, which is a phenomenal 30 for 30 that they did on the rise and fall of the Big East. And a lot of people pine for the old Big East, you know, Syracuse and Georgetown and Boston College. And there's a world that wishes that we were at, that we still had that old school Big East. And then I look at sort of the fact that we won't allow that to happen in today's world. I'll use a great example. You know, you want colorful coaches. You want mm-hmm. guys that have big personalities. You know, last year we had a little spat with Rhode Island and UMass.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, Bergeron was in the mix there. And it looked like everyone blew it way out of proportion. But, you know, 30 years ago, Calipari, or even 20 years ago, Calipari is – and, you know, going toe to toe with Temple,
yeah,
and Cheney. And, you know, that's a iconic moment. And, you know, look at Thompson at Georgetown and Boeheim at Syracuse, like at each other's throats. You know, that's good, I think.
Yeah.
Good for the conference and the rivalries. And then to spin off of that, major markets. Like, what other mid-major has the major market pull and appeal? And maybe that's why Fordham is still kind of in the mix,
right?
Where you have those levels, and I'm talking media deals where, you know, all of our games for the most part at UMass are on NESN, which is 5 million subscribers across 6 states, and then mm-hmm. another 6 million nationally. SLU with Fox Sports, you know, at Dayton as well. I mean, VCU on Masson, which is where the Orioles play. I mean, there's a lot of good media exposure. I think we need to figure out how to capitalize on that and turn that into that, like, definitive basketball mid-major conference. And at the same time I say that, I don't know where UMass stands because they are the only one in it with FBS football.
Yeah, that is kind of an interesting situation, I guess, where UMass is really the only A10 school that has that highest level of football that they've had for a few years now. But overall, too, I think with the A10, even though there are a lot of smaller private schools like your Davidsons and Daytons, I do think, for the most part, there is a lot of passion in the fan bases that kind of makes up for the lack of numbers. So, you know, it does seem like the tools are there for the A10. You know, some programs like Fordham obviously need to pull their weight a little bit more, but it seems like they're making some changes within their athletic department. And that could be a huge boost if the A10 suddenly has a good team in New York City. That seems like, from a media and recruiting perspective, that would be huge.
Yeah, it's funny because, I'm a sucker for history and I love Rose Hill Gym, man. The A-10 has so many cool venues, from Hawk Hill to even Davidson, as you mentioned, which is maybe a newer campus, but still a cool experience to be a part of. Obviously, Dayton blows the doors off of any basketball atmosphere. You want it to work, I think, for a team like Fordham, and for whatever reason, this has been talked about, ad nauseum, but for whatever reason, they just can't seem to get it all together.
Yeah, and I think the conference is basically the way you described it, facing the same challenge that like we are personally with this podcast, where all of these teams have this great legion of core fans, and we could start spouting off the names. We all know these great few dozen fans that each team has on Twitter who are just truly passionate, and those are the guys who are pushing this conference, who are going to every game, who are maybe not necessarily listening to our podcast, but they might be listening to Hey 10 or SBU Unfurled and Friends or Blackburn Review, any of these. But the difficulty in growing these schools and in growing media in this conference is capturing the casual fans' attention.
Right.
And Dayton has done that really well, and VCU has done that really well. And for the other schools, it's been kind of on and off depending on success. So I think UMass is a great example. If you guys get really good, I expect to see that gym sold out and rocking. But what happens 5 years from now when Trey Mitchell and TJ Weeks are long gone and there's a down year? How do you capture those fans and get them to stay?
Yeah, no, it's a good point. And I've had these conversations just casually with friends and family. I don't know if you guys know anything about my background, but I spent 16 years as a full-time employee in minor league baseball, where I pretty much on a daily basis, they tell you that the game and the outcome do not matter. It's all about the experience, the family-friendly atmosphere and coming out and having a good time and seeing some fireworks. So I think there's some of that mentality that not only UMass but other programs can bring in, where it's like, hey, we might not win, but by the way, like most of these teams win more at home than they lose, right? So you go probably go like 10-5 at home. You play some teams you should beat. That's a whole nother problem because you're not getting UConn and mid big Power Five schools to go on the road anymore or play anybody out of conference. That's a whole nother conversation. But how do you build it not just on one or two guys or one or two years of success, but really develop fans for life that love the experience and can't be away from it? And I'll also say this, when I go back to that Big East documentary, the one thing that they did is they drove down to the, emerging network of ESPN, and they said, hey, we want to be on TV. And ESPN was like, great, we need some content, right? What's that next level? The A-10 has the ESPN Plus deal, which is great because you can watch all the games. But, in the long term, is that where you want to be? What's the thing that is on the horizon that you need to be the first at? Is it going to Netflix and saying, hey, we're going to give you exclusivity for all of our games that people can watch on demand on Netflix? There might need to be some sort of groundbreaking change from a technology standpoint to then be the first in that field, I think.
I think that we're in kind of a great place as one of the stronger mid-major conferences right now, because as everything up top gets thrown in flux, where we're seeing now some of these top one and dones just aren't even going to go to college. We're seeing an increase in transfers, and you're kind of losing the essence of college basketball in the Power Fives, which is something people complain about all the time. But those same people complaining don't take the time to look at a program like Richmond, who have a chance to start five seniors next year, four of whom have been in the program the entire time. And so the essence of college basketball still exists in this conference, and it's maybe the best conference in the country, probably either them or the Mountain West, in terms of getting these guys and keeping them for 4 years and reminding people the way college basketball used to be.
And I mean, look, like people see what they want to see, right? They won't see what Mooney has built at Richmond because it doesn't fit their narrative. And I think there was a lot of talk. I think it was the Perlman article or the Rothstein article that came out about, you know, how the one and done or the transfer rule will change things, and guys going to the G League directly will change things. But yeah, at the end of the day, you know, March Madness is so ingrained in Americana, like that's not going anywhere.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it might actually lead to what you just said, more growth of guys that can be more competitive over a 4-year period at specific institutions. And I will say this, what Bernadette McGlade did, I think really well, was set up this mid-season tournament against the Mountain West.
Mm-hmm.
And you see more of these conferences, the Power Fives going to 20 game, you know, conference schedules, you're getting squeezed out. You know, how do you get those intense matchups that you need? And I think that certainly fits the bill.
Yeah, and that's something I wouldn't be surprised too, to see the A-10 eventually move to a 20 game schedule, because it just might be necessary if teams aren't able to fill their non-conferences with less opportunities on the horizon. And
Or you go to the CUSA version where you kind of rotate the bottom guys out against your top teams.
Honestly, I'm not a huge fan of that, just because I feel like Conference USA is pretty much always a one bid league, where I think the A-10 normally has at least one or two teams that are at large caliber. But yeah, I do think it's important for the A-10 to keep exploring all options to keep this conference as competitive as possible. And so far, I feel like they've done a good job with that. With the Mountain West Challenge next year, I think that's a pretty good opportunity, because Power 5 teams are getting more and more reluctant to schedule games against A-10 schools and other mid-majors. I mean, this year, Dayton's best home out-of-conference game was against North Texas. So, you know, when a team as good as UD isn't able to bring any, you know, big names into the arena for a home game, that shows how tough it is. And
yeah, and you wonder if there's a structural change at some point, mm-hmm. you know, and who knows what the coronavirus outcome will be, and things, you know, out of the ashes, maybe something will change.
Mm-hmm.
You know, teams might need to find more money somewhere. Maybe, who knows? You're right. That is kind of tough. And then two, your only on the national stage is at those non-conference tournaments early on in the season. You know, UMass played UVA and St. John's, which were two good matchups,
mm-hmm.
and they played competitively, but you know, you're expected to sort of lose those games. Somebody in the A-10, maybe one or two teams, need to win those games mm-hmm. at the start of the season each year to kind of then propel the rest of the league, which doesn't really seem fair, but sort of kind of is the way it is. I will say this, and the athletic director at UMass, Ryan Bamford, is part mad genius for the way that he's been able to construct things. Because of the Minutemen having FBS football, they have attached their bye games to SEC schools in football to home and homes in basketball. So, you know, the Minutemen hosted Georgia 3 years ago at the Mullen Center, mm-hmm. beat them, and then went on the road 2 years ago and lost down in Athens. So, like, you know, next year they're doing it with Rutgers, which is going to be a great program to get into your arena at the, you know, early portion of the season or end of the non-conference slate. And I think that does make the Minutemen more unique in a way where they have been able to negotiate those Power Fives, not only to get those deals, but to get them to come to your place.
Yeah, that's something I really want to see more of, is just A-10 teams challenging themselves more out of conference. And I think UMass, you know, they do have that advantage with football, but I think they did as good of a job as anybody is building a good non-conference schedule. But, yeah. You know, we have teams like Fordham and George Mason. You look at who they played last year, and that's not doing anything for the strength of the conference. So I'm hoping, you know, maybe the Mountain West Challenge encourages teams to play better opponents. But I really did like what UMass did last year, and I hope more teams try to follow that.
Well, for those that don't know, Amherst is about 100 miles from Boston. So one mm-hmm. of the goals for the athletic director and the program has been, hey, how do we play in the Boston market once every year? So mm-hmm. they've set up great home and home situations with Harvard, with Northeastern, with, you know, Yale's on the schedule. Those are those are intriguing matchups. And I think Yale and Harvard ended up being, you know, top 75 teams in mm-hmm. the net rankings at the end of the season. They played a road game at Fairfield. I mean, and maybe that's the route you have to go to as well. Like, hey, we'll play anybody anywhere. And it becomes tougher the better you get, right? Like you said, no one wants to come into UD Arena and play yeah. Dayton. I think you only benefit from a tough schedule to get your players to play against the highest level of competition. And I'd like to see a lot more of that in the Atlantic 10.
Mm-hmm.
I did DC for 3 or 4 years, and you know, early part of the schedule, you're playing Grambling State and, you know, Prairie View A&M, and like, you know, that doesn't help you.
I know it's a source of pride for some teams that they don't want to basically admit that they're a mid-major and take like a 2-for-1 or a 3-for-1 deal, but I think that might be the route that some of these teams have to start to go down to play better competition. And you look at a game for the upcoming season where Richmond is going into Kentucky, and I don't know if we ever found out if there's like a home and home attached to that, or it's a bye game or what, but Richmond's got a chance to make the NCAA tournament next year. And I love that they're going to have to go to Rupp Arena and play a tough Kentucky team early in the year mm-hmm. in a game that, by the way, they're good enough to actually win.
Yeah. That feels like kind of the stars aligning, right? Where they've got this team that has matured over the years and has now become fully healthy. And then they land a game against Kentucky. I mean, I think, I don't know what the spread should be, 8 points in that game, you know, like, especially early on in the season. That's a great move. And, you know, like, and I think to twist it back to UMass, I think to kind of get back to the excitement levels of the mid-90s, you have to win a big non-conference game against a Power 5 opponent on national TV, and you have to go back to the tournament and win a game. And, you know, I don't know if that's in the cards for this year or the following year, but those are things that you have to do to of your, not only your program, but the state and New England basketball.
Mm-hmm. Is there any relationship at all between UMass and Boston College at this point?
I know there's a football game on the horizon. From what I understand, this predates me. I think UMass beat BC the last 3 games they played, and not at BC, but down in Boston in a neutral site. And the last one was ugly. You can look it up. I think it was like a 30-point blowout win for Chaz Williams and the boys. And after that, you know, BC was like, uh-uh. We're not doing this again.
Yep.
And you've seen a lot of that actually, even from the football side, where, you know, UMass will win a game and then the opponent's like, nah, okay, we're not doing that again. And like, to get on this high horse of I've been isolated and I can like kind of try to like digest these thoughts. How many times have we, the fans, the media, been lectured by, you know, headstrong coaches who have lived their whole world in the athletic field? And they say how soft the kids are and how they're not adjusting to criticism and they want to transfer when they don't get playing time. And the second one team beats you at a lower level, you cancel the series. I mean, that's as soft and snowflakish as you can possibly get. And it happens way more than it should. And then these coaches who are lecturing you about your toughness go on to schedule the easiest schedule that they've ever had to keep their job.
And I hear people all the time too that complain like about Dayton this year. They didn't play anybody. They didn't beat anyone out of conference, which is kind of true. But no one, that's a problem with the Power 5. You guys won't play us. You don't give the A-10 schools right. a chance to win those games. So it's kind of like, what are you asking us to do? I mean, right. it feels unfair to complain about an A-10 school not playing a difficult schedule when you're part of the problem.
Yeah. And maybe that's where the committee gets involved, where, mm-hmm. you know, they ding you for not playing, you know, they ding Power Fives for not playing a tougher non-conference schedule. But yeah, I mean, if you're afraid to play somebody because it's going to make you look bad if you lose, then what are you in the competitive field for to begin with?
Yep. Definitely agree.
And I'm someone who really believes in keeping your geographic rivals close. And My favorite example is just to talk about Dayton, where I feel like Ohio State should be willing to take a quote-unquote step down to play Dayton every year, but Dayton should be willing to take the same step to play Wright State. And right now I look at those geographical rivalry games that either are happening irregularly or not happening at all. You have three top half A-10 teams that should be playing the three worst teams in the ACC every year, where you've UMass Boston College, Duquesne Pitt, and Davidson Wake Forest. And those are three, especially this next year, those would be three really nice opportunities for the A-10 to beat a Power 5 team.
Yeah.
I think Wake Forest actually did beat Davidson last year.
Like,
but
at the end of the day, yeah. At the end of the day, like, the ACC money is still going to come in, right? Whether you lose to Duquesne or win, you're still getting a $38 million check for your school. So probably more of a deep-rooted issue. But I do know, and that's kind of like, I don't, you guys obviously think know this world a lot better than I do. I'm sort of still kind of new to it on a full-time basis. But from what I've learned about the scheduling, and again, to go back to the athletic director here, like, it's important for him to play those rivalry regional games. And what you just said would benefit not only obviously the A-10, but more so would benefit the fans of the city of Pittsburgh or the fans in the region of Ohio. It would benefit them way more to see those regional rivalries than it would to see Ohio State host, you know, North Texas. Be at the end of the day, like, that's the economic engine, is the fan interest. And I think that obviously hasn't been taken into account for a lot of the growth of college sports, and it probably should.
I'm just really interested to see what kind of just how the A-10 changes the next couple of years, as we might have a new transfer rule. The big conferences are going to play more conference games, which that might throw off the strength of schedule numbers and make it tougher for A-10 teams to get a bid. And then just coming back from coronavirus, I mean, we don't really know what basketball is going to look like when it happens next year. But I'm just interested to see, you know, if the A-10 can kind of maintain its presence as a top mid-major conference. And I really hope, you know, the last thing I want to see is for the divide between the big and small conferences. I don't want to see that divide grow, but I think it is such an interesting situation right now where everybody's kind of locked down and we might have some new rule changes on the horizon.
Right.
I just, it's hard to predict what the A-10 is going to look like even next season.
No, I agree. And, you know, even if there is going to be a next season, but I will say this, and this is kind of what I was trying to allude to earlier. And at some point, when you look at some of these teams like VCU, like Dayton, I mean, you're a fool to think that they're not going to have opportunity to spread their wings and go elsewhere because the basketball programs are so good.
Mm-hmm.
How do you not only keep it together, move it forward, but excel? And I think this will be interesting coming out of this crisis. You know, how do you not only continue to maintain what you've got, but add to it and be more marquee and be more relevant. And it, I think that saying of, if you're not moving forward, you're moving backwards. Like, I think that's going to be even more important coming out of what we're dealing with here for the conferences. And look, there's smart people in place, much smarter than you and I that I think understand that and know that. It's just, hopefully they can kind of make it happen.
Well, as A-10 podcasters, I think we try to do our part. We hype up the A-10 as a Power 8 conference, which...
You've done a great job, man.
Yeah.
You guys have done a great job.
Which may or may not be true, but no, it's... you know, hopefully the conference just keeps getting exposure, though.
Yeah, you guys done a great job. You know, you ever listen to podcasts and it gets like... There's like 15 minutes of inane chit-chat before you actually get to the content. Like, you guys just nix all that. And you're like, let's just talk hoops. And it's great. And I thank you for having me on. I will say I didn't mention one guy in the recruiting class, DeAndre Dominguez, who's another Woodstock kid. He's a 3-4 guy. He can shoot from the outside as well. So, yeah, excited about the incoming class. And thank you guys for letting me rant on all things college athletics for a good 35 minutes.
Hey, no problem. It was a lot of fun. We definitely need to keep talking some basketball just to keep ourselves busy right now. And it's just good to think about sports because there really hasn't been much going on recently.
Yeah. All right, we'll do it again.
All right, sounds good.
Thanks, guys.
Thanks again to Jay Burnham for joining us on the podcast. And thank you for listening to this episode. We really enjoyed doing a podcast for the first time in a while. And we have some other stuff planned for the off season, so make sure you keep an eye out for any new episodes. You can follow us on Twitter at 3BidLeaguePod, and you can listen to us on Apple, Spotify, and Castbox.
St. Joseph's season comes down to this. Miles gets a three. Spider fans, the Richmond Spiders are Sweet 16 bound. Robert, I submit to you, Davidson College to the Sweet 16. Denham Brown for three.